Welcome to the Balanced Perspective Podcast, where we're going to be challenging perspectives on what it actually takes to be successful in both business and in life. I'm your host, Terri Ann Richards, and with 16 years as a serial entrepreneur, I've experienced some of life's most epic successes and failures. Join me as we journey on a mission to blow the lid off of some of the best kept secrets to living a life of true success from the inside out. Welcome back to the Balanced Perspective Podcast. I am really excited to dig in today with Dr. Kevin Payne. Dr. Kevin Payne is a social psychologist, entrepreneur, author, podcast host, speaker, teacher. He shares the results of his extensive research concerning how to live a quality life with chronic distress, pain, and illness. He also shares his personal exploits as a collector of experiences, even while battling multiple cirrhosis for decades. Life is too remarkable to sit on the sidelines, even when we've got to get more creative about how we get in the game. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Terri Ann. I'm delighted to be here.
Kevin, let's start unpacking a little bit of your journey into becoming the entrepreneur and the leader that you are today. Take me back to maybe the beginning of this process into discovering that this was sort of your purpose and your light.
Well, if we start with the entrepreneurship side, that's probably a good place to begin. And for me, I had been evidencing an entrepreneurial bent from the time I was a teenager. My first job, I was self-employed, and when most kids were pushing the lawnmower or having a paper route, I started giving computer programming lessons. And I started doing contract work for small businesses in the area that needed programming done. So I became a computer entrepreneur from the time I was about, probably about 13 or so.
Wow. I always love when I hear people who can go back that far and remember when their first entrepreneurial spark was. Mine was when I was much younger as well. I was about 9 or 10 and I had bunny rabbits. And I learned quickly that bunny rabbits make lots of other bunny rabbits. And you can't keep them all. And so other people, children, wanted rabbits. So I would go to the end of my driveway with this toy box full of bunny rabbits, and I would sell them for $5 or $10 a piece and make coin. And I thought I was on top of the world.
That is cool. So I guess part of that also, you know, for me is I've never liked working for other people. And so a few years later, I got my first job in high school. You know, that was like a standard, let's clock in and clock out sort of job at a local gas station that had a soda fountain. And I did that. And I very, very, very quickly learned that I did not like clocking in and out. So I did some sales jobs, but I was always in school. And I always knew I was going to be an academic. And I always knew I was going to go on and be a scientist of some kind. So through the 90s, I'm working on my dissertation and I start teaching college and doing research. And as regular gigs go, being a professor is pretty freeform and you're kind of left up to your own devices. Now, I spent the last 7.5 years as a professor managing a large department as well. So I had 150 instructors at 30 locations around the world that were reporting to me. And we had over 10,000 student enrollments a year. So I got the management part of that experience, and I was allowed to be entrepreneurial in that role because it was a major that had not been changed since the 70s. They brought me in 2006, expressly to bring it up to date and do something new with it. So I almost doubled the student enrollments. So I had the entrepreneurial bent. as a professor, I got this experience that said, yeah, I can do this organizational building out of something in my field. And I thought, yeah, there was no place for me to go in the academy past that, because goodness knows, under no circumstances did I ever want to be a dean or an academic administrator of some kind. That's just not for me. So I had had this technology that I, I was pretty certain I could find a market for it out of the research that I'd been doing for many years. So in 2012, I left the academy. I left the safest job in the world as a tenure track professor to the riskiest job in the world as a tech entrepreneur. And by the way, to fill your audience in on this, I have multiple sclerosis. And I've lived with MS. I was first symptomatic in 1989 when I was in college. I didn't get a correct diagnosis until 2006. So I lived with weird, random symptoms that came and went off and on for 17 years there before I finally got an answer to it. And during that time also, as I'm slowly getting to the point where I'm sort of fed up with being a professor and navigating what life would look like for me with MS, my then wife also had gone through mystery symptoms herself. And those turned out to be, after a decade of her mystery symptoms, that turned out to be a very, very late stage 3 chromophobe renal cell carcinoma, hormone secreting. We got her saved at the last instant, and with a radical surgery, and things were starting to look up in my life. And I was thinking, yeah, okay, now we can finally make this jump. And we had, it was really crucial for my story, we finally had a public healthcare option in the United States, because I had spent the last couple of years handcuffed to my job because I had to have medical care for myself and my then wife. And of course, we had young kids at the time too. So I couldn't go out and be innovative as an entrepreneur until I had something that could handle this healthcare, because there's no way I will ever get a solo health policy, not with multiple sclerosis. It's one of the most expensive conditions you can possibly have.
Wow.
So finally that happened. We had a public health insurance option. I left. Things were looking good. Then I'm launching this first company. We're building this technology. And remember, it's all coming out of my brain. I had a great team around me. We were building the technology. And I had an exacerbation to my MS that was devastating. And it was unlike anything that I'd ever experienced before. Most people think of MS as, oh, that's one of those that puts you in a wheelchair. And yeah, for some of us it does, but not nearly as many as it does now as it used to. But there are also cognitive and emotional and other kinds of symptoms, because for MS, our immune system is eating away our brain and our spinal cord. And wherever that damage occurs, that's the kind of symptom you get. So wow. I had a massive right frontal temporal exacerbation. And that meant that a lot of my higher abstract thinking had just been blown up. My ability to process social signals, to regulate my emotions, damage in that part of the brain looks very much like dementia.
Okay.
And suddenly I could not recognize myself. My family couldn't recognize me. I got really depressed because, you know, now, what am I going to do? We're out there with no net, and suddenly what I depend on is no longer reliable. And my wife and my children decided that this was too much for them to deal with, and they left. And so now I'm alone.
Wow.
And then my dog, my Akita, died. But so that was the last thing I was hanging on to. I mean, literally everything that I was hanging on to in life, my career, my academics, my, you know, business aspirations, my family, and my beloved dog, poof, all gone. And I was at the end of my rope.
Okay, so
my life was like dissolving in slow motion from like about 2013 through, you know, 17 or so. It was just one thing after another.
So that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot if you were to like disperse that among a few people. Much more for just one individual. And I'm positive that there are people, whether they've had chronic illness or separation, divorce, death. I mean, anybody who's listening to this can sort of put their hand up and relate in some fashion. Help me understand how that is the catalyst, is the spark, is the something that gets you on this path where you're now doing what we know that you do today. Like, make the link for me that allows this to become, this is your platform. Like, you are literally on a day-to-day basis. You've authored a book. You work with individuals who have chronic health illnesses, and you will allow them through your framework to live a life well. And so help me understand, connect that.
Yeah, a lot of what I do is also training medical health and wellness professionals, because they're trained according to an acute care model. And most of what they do doesn't work well for us. And unfortunately, now over 50% of all Americans are living with a chronic health diagnosis.
Stop there for a second, because there's two things you just said that I think we almost need to go. I'm playing ignorance for a second. And in some ways, I think I might even be. So chronic health conditions, illness, unpack that a bit for me. And then unpack the side where physicians are not potentially always equipped to work with individuals with. So on the two sides of that spectrum, share that with me in the audience.
So a chronic illness, there's a little bit of debate over how exactly to define it, but the most generally accepted definition is any medical condition that lasts at least 3 months.
Okay.
And that is not just physical, but mental health conditions as well.
Okay.
And so when you count it like that, then at any given time, a little over half of all Americans are living with something that is persistent and is not going to go away, or at least not going to go away anytime soon. And 18% of us have five or more chronic health diagnoses.
Wow.
And this is just mind-boggling.
I want a reason. Why?
Well, we are still trying to figure that out. There's lots and lots of epidemiological and social health research that's going on, trying to understand this, environmental health research. There are really two reasons. One, we're better at diagnosing them. So we just understand that this is a chronic health condition now, and we didn't necessarily know that. Just like, you know, when I was first diagnosed with MS in the early 2000s, we didn't yet at the time understand that MS was an autoimmune condition. Now we do. And now we know that there are over 100 kinds of autoimmune conditions that people deal with. Rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, the list goes on and on and on.
So am I correct in thinking that chronic illness is like the quiet, not so much quiet to the person who's experiencing it, but it's not really seen. Like, in other words, you can't look at somebody. I can't look at you and know that you potentially have one or more chronic health conditions, right? It's sort of, it's like a masked illness struggle.
Most of us have what are called invisible illnesses, because nobody can see that I am in chronic pain. Nobody can see that I'm chronically fatigued. Nobody can see that I have cognitive fog that I'm always having to strain to interpret the world through and make sense of things. Nobody can see that I have 30 other symptoms that come and go as my MS waxes and wanes. The only time that they notice is when I get really tired or really overheated or really cold. My legs have a tendency in one way or another not to work.
Wow. Okay. I feel like what you're saying kind of shines a really bright light on this mental health struggle that the entire world, but let's just stick with North America for now. I can't imagine. So we know statistically that entrepreneurs, people in high achievers by nature struggle with more mental health challenges in silence. And so if you add the next layer to that, if you have 100 entrepreneurs, you're saying statistically that 50 of them potentially have chronic illnesses. And we know that somewhere between like 70 and 80% of entrepreneurs struggle with mental health issues. I'm making the assumption without knowing the data that that has to be even that much higher if you're an entrepreneur who's also somebody who's struggling with a chronic health issue. Help me understand. I think of some of the trainings that I've taken where there's still this taboo out there. I have entrepreneurial friends that one of their team members hasn't come to work and, you know, they look fine. I saw them on social media. They're out eating a burger. They look fine, but they're struggling with something else. Like that's my guess, right?
Yeah. Look fine is just such an awful metric to try to use.
Why are we still using it though?
Well, okay. I get into this in the first couple of chapters of my book. And try to explain this so that we can kind of understand it. But let's go back to, let's tie this in with something that you had asked about before that we hadn't gotten to, about the acute care model and medical health and wellness professionals, okay? So the acute model of illness is this idea that normally we're healthy, then something happens to us. It may be an illness or an injury, whatever it is, we have a medical problem. And that medical problem can be identified through the medical system, and it can be assigned a medical treatment, and that treatment can be followed, and then we will be returned to our normal, healthy life. Okay, so that's the implicit way that we think about dealing with illness. So in other words, health isn't anything we need to think about. We only think about it when the car starts making a funny noise.
Reactionary. Right?
Exactly. It's reactionary and it's fundamentally sick care. And this is not only the way medical training is done. This is the way that all of us implicitly learn health and illness from the time that we're tiny and we're observing the world. And as a little kid, you may break an arm or you may get the flu, and you know that you can feel bad, groan about it, laze around, take your meds, everybody will cut you some slack, and then you go back to life as normal. And when other people get quote unquote sick, you're going to do the same for them.
Yes.
But that model doesn't work with us. And we have to figure out ways to live a good life, because nobody wants to be stuck living in that sick role for years or decades, right? And in the United States, in 2019, we spent $3.8 trillion on medical care. 87% of that was for chronic health care.
Wow.
So this is massive. And one of the reasons why, even before the pandemic, burnout amongst the medical health, wellness, and caring professions was already at an all-time high. Part of that is operating under continual distress. And part of that is trying to sandwich care for people with chronic conditions who are never going to get better into this poorly fitting acute care model where we're trying to fix it and then walk away. And that doesn't work. So now we're trying to make the best of a bad system that is constantly failing all of us, and we all get frustrated and we all get distressed. And that's where I come in. Because as a social psychologist, I couldn't contribute to a medical solution. Wrong kind of doctor for that.
Yeah.
But if we look at the data, 67% of health outcomes are not due to medical factors. They're due to cognitive, emotional, behavioral, social, and environmental factors. And those are all things that I know something about. And those are all things that we can manipulate. So okay. Even though I still have MS, by learning to manipulate those other factors in my life, I can greatly improve my quality of life and indirectly, sometimes my quality of health as well.
Can you share some ideas about that? And I'm just looking at this from a perspective shift, right? Because like I said, like I've had these conversations with people, whether it's around chronic health or mental health, to me, it's just sort of these invisible.
It's the same thing.
Me, it's just these invisible things that nobody really wants to admit that somebody else potentially has because they don't understand it. And people are ignorant to it. And as much as we've done a ton of work, I think, over the years on talking about some of these issues, from my regard, I don't believe we've talked enough. I'm having these conversations with people because I'm hearing staff being out and all of this stuff. And I feel like there needs to be a perspective shift. So talk to me a little bit about what are some of the things that the people who are challenged can do, but maybe also like, what are some of the things that people who are in their world can do?
Well, there fortunately is a huge overlap in those things because a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are not very kind to ourselves. We do a lousy job of being kind to ourselves. And I would invite everybody to think about this for a second. You have a relationship with yourself just as you have a relationship with other people. And if somebody else treated you like you treat you, would you allow them to maintain a relationship with you? No. Because most of us are just really crummy about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is no wonder that so many of us are walking around so frustrated and angry and uncomfortable and distressed. Because fundamentally, we're stuck in a carcass with somebody who doesn't respect us, who abuses us. And when you throw a chronic illness into the mix, then this is frightening. It's really terrifying. And for me, you know, I'm historically was not a person that met the world through fear. I've always been one of those people that would say, yeah, sure, okay, to whatever new experience came around. I like collecting experiences. That's why I've got so many colorful stories, because I made sketchy decisions and I survived them. One of the frustrating things was, as my body started betraying me more and more often, I became afraid of my own body. And I became someone who was pulling back from the world. Because you end up paralyzed on the floor a few times, and I guarantee you that's going to cause you to think twice about saying yes to some things. I mean, it's just as simple as that. So because I had reached that point, because I had lost so much in my life and I'd started saying no to all of these dreams that I'd once had, that's how I got back into skydiving. Jumping out of a plane didn't have anything to do with fear of heights, because I'd started the training back in the 90s the first time, got a handful of jumps in, and then a lot of life got in the way, and then my MS got really bad, and I thought, I'm never going to be able to get back to this. But in 2019, when I hit bottom, and I really do mean hit bottom, I could no longer see a path from the life I was living to anything. I said, I'm going to give myself one more chance before I completely give up. And it really was that. I said, I had this childhood dream of being a skydiver, a legit skydiver. And that means, for those who don't know, to get all of the licenses in the sport, it takes 500 jumps. And there are four levels of licensing. Then you are eligible for professional ratings and that sort of thing. So in 2019, I went back. It normally takes 25 jumps to get your first license, your A license. It took me 47 because I had to figure out how to control my legs in free fall, even when I can't feel them. So it was a crazy journey. A lot of people helped me, and I managed to get there. So I logged 140 jumps. So in 2020, I said, I'm going to set myself a more significant goal. And that is, I'm going to jump better than once a day, every day for the entire year. And I'm going to get myself across 500 and complete the licenses and get a coach rating. And I did. I logged 370 jumps in 2020 when everybody else was huddled in their homes. I was screaming through the sky at terminal velocity. And that's how I spent that first year of my pandemic. But to me, that was about, look at it this way. If you look at the cover of my book, this picture, it took 8 jumps over 6 weeks to get that exact image. And that tells the story of the book. I'm at 5,000 feet when that picture is taken, headed to Earth at 120 miles an hour. That means in that instant, my life expectancy was 27 seconds if I did nothing, less than a TV commercial. And I've got my hands up here to my forehead, and I'm about to sweep them out. And that's a gesture all skydivers know. It's called the wave off. I'm warning everyone in my airspace, I am about to take active action to save myself. Now think about that for a second. How many times in our lives, day to day, are we presented with an opportunity to actively, literally choose life? And when people pick this up, I want them to understand you are making an active choice to save yourself. Because I'm not going to give you a one path, because one path doesn't work for everyone. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you how to choose for yourself.
I think that's really powerful for somebody who has been living with one of these challenges for any significant amount of time. Talk to me about the people who are around them. You talk about your family, obviously, who left. I'm putting this in the perspective of the family members, the friends, the coworkers. I keep going back to these conversations I'm having with people where coworkers get resentful when the person hasn't been to work for a week or two. Like, there's almost this two sides to the coin where it's like the person who's struggling and then the people who don't understand that they're struggling. And it's almost like there's like a communication gap. And there's also some ignorance there too, because maybe they know what the struggle is, whether or not it's their business. And maybe they know what it is and they don't understand it. They don't understand the impacts on that person's life.
That is exactly what I was going to say here. And you nailed it. And I use that language in the book. We can know things from the outside looking in, but understanding comes from the inside looking out. Mm. And there is a massive disconnect. And part of that is because, and you know, I've lived both sides of this. I had years of my own symptoms that I'm struggling to communicate but I also had a wife with years of symptoms that we were that she was trying to communicate and we were trying to understand. And the point here is people don't get it. Let's go back to that acute care model to begin, you know, and in that model, we are taught that when we are sick, we are supposed to act in a particular way. And when people act that way, we are taught to recognize them as sick. And the caveat there is they're going to get through that and then they're going to get better. Everything about living with a chronic illness violates that implicit social contract. Because we're going to try to live as well as we can any opportunity that we can. But we're not always going to be able to do that because we have these constraints that others can't see. Wow. And that's really frustrating from the outside looking in. If you are an observer or a friend, you think, oh, that's really convenient. And I'm like here to tell everybody, you know, I feel comfortable speaking for everyone living with a chronic condition here. No, it is not convenient. It's not fun. It's not our choice because humans are always trying to make attributions about other humans. We're trying to understand why people do what they do. And kind of the default in the attributions we make is that, oh, someone chooses to do something or another. If you can't see an external constraint, then you put it in the choice bucket.
Yes.
But if you're on the outside looking in, you can't see the real health constraints that are quite apparent to me. And I, as someone living with it, don't want to keep beating you up with my reality all the time. I don't want to keep reminding you, yeah, I am always in pain. I am always medically fatigued. Not only do you not understand what that's like unless you live it, you're going to get really tired of hearing about it, and I'm going to get really tired of talking about it. And we know that in any human relationship, we've got to maintain a balance between an overwhelming amount of positive interactions versus some negative interactions, right? You know, and Gottman's research is 5-1. And that kind of helps. You know, it's a pretty good way of thinking about it.
So what's the solution? So, I'll say to you what I think the solution is, because to me, it sounds like almost anything that happens in life, you know, you think of the division of the world right now as it is, right? Mm-hmm. Differing of opinions on certain, you know, political thoughts or whatever it is. I think at the end of the day, you just got to stay curious enough and kind enough to understand that you can't always completely understand someone's view. Sometimes you got to be standing 20 stories up to really understand the view, and maybe you don't have the way to get there. And so I think then it just comes down to being curious enough to know, and then to be kind enough to know that you might not ever know enough for it to validate a certain checkbox for you.
You are a remarkably perceptive person, because those are actually the two words I keep coming back to in good chunks of the book. Let's go with kindness first. Mm-hmm. And I like to use kind rather than the word love or the word care, because those are easily misinterpreted.
Very much so.
Kind is a much more precise word. And kind is not nice. Nice is superficial, right?
Oh, I love that you say that. I literally have done an entire talk on the difference between nice and kind. Yeah. And I don't like being nice because it's superficial. It's not real. It's inauthentic. And typically it's to make you feel better, but I'm not in alignment to myself.
It's often a display behavior. It's much more about me being seen as nice than doing something for you.
So true.
And so kindness requires a real effort at empathy. And it requires, even if it's really small, some kind of real sacrifice. And we need to be more kind. And that begins with being more kind to ourselves.
So true. You can't give what you don't have, right?
Exactly. And And we need to be curious. And this goes back to, because I was talking about attributions that we make. And here's another little nugget from the research. And that is that amongst the people that know one another the best, so we're talking about long-term domestic cohabitators, when you make an attribution about your partner, you are correct about 50% of the time. That's it. The people that we think we know the very best in the world, we accurately discern their motivations about half the time.
Wow.
So that means we're screwed with everybody else.
So screwed.
And the important point here is that while we should all try empathy, just realize that no matter how much you try to be empathetic, you're still going to suck at it. And that's okay, because it's the effort that's going to be the important thing. But what that also means is when somebody is extending empathy to you, you have to be able to meet that with honesty. And you have to communicate, well, yeah, I appreciate that you are trying to be empathetic with me, but here's what's actually going on. And then you can't, as somebody who is extending empathy and who's trying to be kind, you can't take that as a rejection of you, because it's not. It's an effort on the other's part to try to get you into the right space, so that we're really understanding one another.
The image is coming in my head right now. And I remember being in therapy years ago with my ex-husband, and this woman took two rubber bands and she put them together and she sort of did this little loop. And so when she pulled it loosely, in the middle was the circle where the two rubber bands were now joined. And then where your fingers were holding on the outside was the two separate. So those would signify, you know, husband, wife, partner, partner, doesn't matter, right?
Sure.
And so, but in the situation you're talking about right now, it's both individuals are coming with their story, their perspective, their views, their struggles, their challenge, their expectations. And by nature, where we struggle in relationships, where most relationships go to die and burn, is when we pull. We pull because that little circle in the middle that represents the potential union of our friendship, our partnership, our relationship, it disintegrates when we pull against, because I want you to do it my way. I want you to see it my way perfectly. Whereas if you lean in, the circle in the middle gets bigger, because you're leaning in and staying, like you said, staying curious enough to just understand enough that you're not going to get it right most of the time. That's the image that's coming in my head.
Well, and think about this. When you are trying to help someone and they say, no, that's not the help I need, how do you respond? A lot of us feel offended.
100%.
And what I want people to understand is, if you are willing to help, are you willing to provide the help that they actually need? Or are you just willing to provide what you expect to be able to give?
I think of even just Gottman, the five love language, right? Like, love people as they need to be loved versus how you want to love them. And I think that's the problem. I think we as humans, we portray a relationship to look a certain way, an employee to act a certain way. And so by nature, those expectations, we like throw them like vomit on people. And somebody says, no, actually, the way I need you to speak to me, communicate with me, the way to help me is this. And it doesn't fit the box that you're used to. And so you're like, well, that's not how I do things. But I mean, if you're a solo robot, you know, living in the universe over here, and you never want to interact with people and have deep relationships, maybe that makes sense. But if you want to have connection, like true connection with people, then you got to lean in and be like, yeah, you're right. I don't potentially know what you need. And I'm interested in learning more about what you need and seeing if I can show up and give that.
Yeah. And this actually goes the other way too, because if you may have in your mind an expectation for the kind of help you're going to get, are you willing or able to take the help that is offered?
This is a different
negotiation that we don't really talk about when we talk about giving and receiving care. But this is at the heart of it.
So beautiful. So Kevin, let's talk a little bit about, so two things. So your book, because I honestly believe, based on our conversation and knowing the statistics, that 5 out of 10 people, basically 50%, are in one way or another struggling with one of these issues, these challenges, these obstacles on a day-to-day basis. And the way the world becomes better is, I think, as we all level up and understand each other that much more deeply. What's the title of your book and where can somebody get it?
If you go to yourlifelivedwell.co, then you can see a snazzy 30 seconds commercial of me jumping out of an airplane, and that's a lot of fun. You can download 100 pages of the book free so that you can see whether it's something that you want to dip into more. You can listen to my podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Payne, for coming on today and sharing your story, your journey, but also shedding light and hopefully shifting perspective on what it means to live well with a chronic illness. So thank you very much for that.
Thanks so much. You too, Terri-Ann.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Balanced Perspective podcast. Listen, if you liked what you heard, can you give me a review? Maybe even a 5-star? All right, have an awesome day.